Deutschlandfunk Kultur. Sein und Streit.
Martha Nussbaum, welcome to the program.
Well, hello, and I'm very glad to be on the program again.
In recent years, cosmopolitanism is often fiercely criticized, attacked even as an elitist view of a mostly urban class of people who have supposedly lost the connection to the normal people, and that in turn has supposedly led to the emergence of right-wing sentiments and policies in the US as well as in Europe. Do you agree with this critique?
Well, I think people are criticizing all kinds of different things and they don't define their terms carefully. What I'm talking about is a tradition that says that our first loyalty should be to the rights and entitlements of every human being in the whole world, and not particularly to our own local region. So that's very different from, I think most people think cosmopolitanism means sophistication, elite culture, and so on. No, this has nothing to do with that, and it's really the ancestor of today's human rights, international human rights movement. So I think then a lot of people still object to that, and you see that in the book I myself do also. So, I mean, the idea that it should be our first loyalty has a lot of problems, I think. And I think it has, first of all, the problem that it could not be the basis for political principles that would be shared among a lot of different people who have different religious views, different secular views. And my view, like John Rawls's view, is that any acceptable political principles have to be narrow enough and thin enough that they can command the allegiance of people who are Catholic and Protestant and Jewish, but also atheist and utilitarian and even Marxist. So that means that we have to say something much weaker, like among our duties should be to foster the human rights of people all over the world. And I think that's something that we can defend. But okay, so that's one of my objections. And I also think that the tradition doesn't understand the nation well enough. Well, of course, it began before there were nations in the modern sense. But already in Rome, Cicero, who's really the one that I'm closest to, criticizes this cosmopolitan tradition for not attaching enough importance to one's own republic, which is the source of so many of our intimate connections and our political responsibilities. But then later, and one of the big chapters is on Hugo Grotius, and Grotius in the 17th century said, the nation is very important because it's the unit that gives human beings autonomy, meaning the power to give themselves laws of their own choosing. And it is also accountable to them in a way that other larger units are not. And I think this is a real serious problem with the international human rights movement. It is not democratic, it is not accountable, and of course, it doesn't therefore serve as a vehicle to give citizens autonomy. I think in a weaker way, even the EU could be criticized from that point of view. The political structure is too weak and too undemocratic. So I do think that the nation state, with all its flaws, is the largest unit we know yet that gives people that direct responsibility and voice in making their own laws. So that if we're going to care for the whole world, it has to start from the nation state.
We will talk about the nation state again later in the second part of the interview. Cosmopolitanism has a long tradition. You have already mentioned this, reaching back to ancient philosophies. So even in times when people were far less informed about what was going on in other parts of the world, and even in times when people were actually less much interconnected, they could develop this view. In our own times, with globalization, digitalization, and so forth, shouldn't we be even more inclined to agree with a cosmopolitan outlook? We are more informed, more connected. Why do we fall back behind this view?
Well, I think in ancient Greece, it is, you're correct, that people were not very connected, and they just thought of this view as a way of criticizing local clannishness and affiliation with one's own city or one's own Deimos. But, you know, the Romans were very different. That was as close to a world state as we've ever had. And so we have the Roman thinkers who developed this view much more fully. We're born in all different parts of the Roman Empire. Seneca was originally born in Spain, probably spoke Spanish as his first language or whatever Spanish there was in those days, and he later moved to Rome and became the regent of the Roman Empire. So, you know, the Roman Empire was very interesting because it did give citizenship, Roman citizenship, to all these far-flung people from Britain all the way to Armenia. So I do feel that that was a good basis for thinking hard about that view. But anyway, sure, today we make choices every day that impact the lives of people in another, in very distant places. When we drink a soda, the people who are making it are in some other place. And all over the world, people are laboring, making the products that we use. So I do think that that gives us an extra kind of responsibility to look into their working conditions, to foster movements for equal labor opportunities, educational quality, environmental quality, all the things that my capabilities approach recommends. And, of course, I end the book with the capabilities approach, which I think is my own replacement for this cosmopolitan tradition.
You have already mentioned Cicero. He admits that we have an obligation of providing equal justice to everybody in the world, but he does not think that we have to offer the same material support to everybody. And you also already mentioned we are interconnected today in our world. If we buy a can of soda here, somebody in another part of the world works for us. Or if we buy, you mentioned this in your book, running shoes, it's very likely that we affect the life of somebody in maybe Southeast Asia. So this distinction by Cicero seems rather half-heartedly, especially in a world of massive global inequality, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the key flaw that I trace all the way through the tradition, is this unwarranted bifurcation between what they call duties of justice, meaning non-aggression and meaning no fraud and so on, and then duties of material aid, which, now, it's not just a negative-positive distinction, however, because Cicero says under duties of justice, we have duties to actually go help our allies if somebody is unjustly attacking them. So once you work it out, those duties of justice require quite a lot of material expenditure, and probably more than it would take to feed the hungry in the whole world. So, you know, that's why the tradition really breaks down and becomes quite incoherent, I think. But material aid is hard because we have to think, what does it mean to give material aid to people in other countries? How can we do that compatibly with their citizenship and their autonomy? So I think one reason the tradition didn't think much about this was that it is just so hard, and today it's still hard. It's hard, first of all, because of paternalism. How can we decide, oh, we should give our money to schools in India? Maybe the people in India would rather use the money a different way. So there's that issue. But there's also the issue that there's a lot of evidence now that the main factor in the well-being of a nation is its own institutional structure, and that foreign aid doesn't always help, and it actually very often hurts, because if people know that money is coming in to help with their health care in a poor part of the world, they're not going to get exercised developing a health infrastructure. They'll think, oh, well, the rich Americans are taking care of that. So it erodes political will and political economy. This is work for which Angus Deaton won the Nobel Prize in economics, and I believe that it's correct. So there's a real problem. If we're well-intentioned and we want to help other people, how on earth are we going to actually do that? So it's a very hard problem.
One focus of your own work is the role of emotions in politics. It seems that cosmopolitanism is more likely to be based on reason than emotions, because we have strong emotions to people who are close to us rather than in other parts of the world. How can we deal with that? Can cosmopolitanism be emotionalized in some way?
Well, this is really one of the big problems that I deal with in the book, because we've evolved to be creatures whose emotions are highly particularistic. They have their root usually in the family, and if we're lucky, they broaden out to deal with fellow citizens in a nation. But good national leaders know that even to do that, you need to deploy symbols and particular geographical images. I wrote another book called Political Emotions that looked at the efforts of some leaders from Franklin Delano Roosevelt to Martin Luther King Jr. to do just that, to use geography, history, particular artistic images to get people to care about their fellow citizens. But then when you think of the whole world, how are you going to do that? Well, the people that I talk about, the Stoics, think the best way to do it is to just uproot the particular. Marcus Aurelius says his first lesson in ethics was not to be a fan of the greens or blues at the races or the light-armed or heavy-armed gladiators at the circus. And what he means is you learn not to root for your own team. And that's the first lesson in ethics. And he's done it so much that all human beings look alike to him, including, he's writing this while he's on campaign with his own army. He was the emperor in the remote part of the empire. And his own soldiers don't look any different from anyone else. And he loses a sense of meaning and purpose. He describes the soldiers fighting in front of his own eyes as crazed mice running for shelter. You know, he just loses a sense that it all means anything at all. So I think that that's a lesson that we should learn from, and that if we want to extend our imaginations, we should not do it by trying to get rid of our local and particular attachments. But then it's constantly a balancing act. How much can we give to our own children? How much should we give to all of our fellow citizens? How much can we give to our own country? How much should we try to help other countries? And all of that is really a balancing act, and I think best mediated at the national level by good institutions, like a good tax structure. So I don't need to every day figure out how much money I should give to poor people in Alabama, because I know that I'm going to pay my income tax, and some politicians, hopefully the ones that I trust, will figure that distributional problem out. The world is much trickier because, of course, there is no world state, and I don't think there should be a world state. So how is this allocation going to go? And so I do think that the world is very tricky, and we all have to try to make the best guess we can about how what we do can help. But I think it helps to remember that money isn't the only thing, that there are other things we can do to help the rest of the world that are probably more helpful than giving money, such as working for an organization that's doing good work, such as giving educational aid. I think that is one kind of foreign aid that does work, technology transfer, but also such as just using whatever career one happens to be in to help other people. So, I mean, educational institutions often offer programs in other countries. Our own university has centers in Delhi, Beijing, and Rio, and other institutions do related things. So we use our own expertise to help other people, and I think that that's actually a sounder way, because it, in a way, it gives more control to the people over there. They invite us in, and they say, well, we would like you to help our students, and so we're not being imperialistic, we're being partners and cooperators. So just one example is that both my country and India, which I've cared about a lot over the years, have huge problems of prejudice and discrimination, and we've had a long-standing big project with our center in Delhi, half Indian scholars and half scholars from our own university, studying prejudice, stigma and discrimination, comparing the Indian caste hierarchy with the discrimination we have in the U.S. against African Americans. And, you know, that kind of project is more egalitarian. We're not telling Indian partners what they should think. We're actually trying to learn from them. And, of course, similar things happen in other professions. We have our center in Delhi also has medical projects. I have economic colleagues who are right now helping with the coronavirus crisis in India by creating new economic models of the disease. So I think that's helpful because it shows us that we don't have to just give a lot of cash and not know quite where it's going, but we can use ourselves in a participatory and responsive way.
You have now already stressed the role that you think the nation state should still play. You say that cosmopolitanism can and should be reconciled in some way with patriotism. But don't nationalism and patriotism contradict true cosmopolitanism?
Well, they say we may and should give a special amount of attention and probably also money to our own nation. And that does contradict maybe some extreme forms of cosmopolitanism, but I don't think it contradicts the most defensible kind, because really it does make sense that we should focus on the people we know and the people we can get to know because of the common institutional structure, because it's in participating in the common tax structure and the common political structure that we express our own autonomy. We can't really do that very well in the world as a whole. And luckily, the evidence is that institutional structures are the main source of wealth and prosperity in every country. So I do think it's a view that makes sense. So the capabilities approach that I've developed begins with thinking about what the guarantees of certain entitlements should be in each nation. But then, of course, at that point, we also move outside the nation and think how the values that we uphold might possibly be recommended and made real in another context. And, of course, that gets into these tricky problems of paternalism. I think right now we're wrestling with this, I think, all of Europe and North America in the case of Hong Kong, because Hong Kong has a precious culture of democracy that comports with our values very well. And now it's being very gravely threatened. So what do we have the right to do? What do we have the right to say to help out that group of people? And so of course, it does raise very large problems. But I think myself that this is a case of unjust aggression that would justify the use of some degree of economic sanctions and maybe even military force if that was something that people were willing to support.
But it seems to me the nation state does not end with its institutions, which you have mentioned now, because there is also this ideology of us versus them, which we regularly face in recent times, and that leads to the exclusion of people, most and for all refugees, for example, or migrants and their descendants. Is that not something which is inevitable with patriotism and nationalism?
No, I don't think so. I think there are different types of patriotism, and therefore I use the word patriotism, not the word nationalism, because the word nationalism is more often associated with this us versus them and us first and so on. Patriotism just means strong love of your own nation, which I think, you know, can be compatible with love of those same values in the whole world. And if you look at someone like Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who founded really our own whatever of a social democracy we still have, he, in every speech, he insisted on saying, and these things hold true not only for America, but also for the whole world. And he meant it. He, of course, the cause of our intervention in World War II, he had a lot of opposition on that. Most Americans just didn't want the trouble, but he persuaded the country to intervene in World War II. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to persuade people to give aid to the Jews or to bomb the railroads that led to Auschwitz, but he just had too much opposition. Eleanor, his wife, had a lot more vehement role in helping the Jews, but she didn't have much power. So anyway, he did what he could, but he used his own political rhetoric to show that we're part of a whole world. Another person who is one of my great heroes is Jawaharlal Nehru, who when the day that India won independence from Britain, when you would think that everyone would be saying, rah, 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 India, he says these dreams are not only for India, but for the whole world, for all the nations and peoples are too close together now for anyone to think that it can live apart. And that, you know, I've got recordings of him giving that speech. And what's so interesting is instead of a lot of rah, 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 there's a very solemn atmosphere, like creating a new nation brings with it responsibility. Now, of course, he, too, had huge opposition, and the gang that's now in charge, I can't tell you how deeply opposed I am to Modi and everything he stands for. That gang was around in Nehru's day already. They were responsible for the assassination of Mohandas Gandhi, and they were doing that because they wanted India first, nothing else, and, of course, the Hindu definition of India. But Nehru was a great patriot, and so was Gandhi. And they were patriots of the sort that I like, who saw the good values of a nation as a bridge to fostering those values in the world as a whole.
We live now in times of a global pandemic, and because of this, we realize more strongly how the world is interconnected globally. As they say, the virus doesn't stop at national borders. So would you say this provides rather hope for cosmopolitanism, or is it more the other way around, that people are guarding their national borders more and more?
Well, you know, you see the best in people and you see the worst at this time. I must say, in my own city and in my own state, by and large, we see the best. For example, in Chicago, there's absolutely widespread obedience to the rules for the lockdown, and also an increased recognition of the toll that our long-standing racism has taken in communities of color. We can't avoid seeing the numbers now that Latinos and African Americans are disproportionately stricken. And the reason they're stricken, of course, is they've all along had inadequate housing, inadequate sources of fresh nutrition, and inadequate health care. And now I think that's on people's minds more than it ever was before. Our mayor, who is herself an African-American woman who also happens to be a lesbian, so she's various different minorities rolled into one, she is very popular in her toughness, and no one is daring. I mean, I sit here looking out at this beautiful lakeshore right outside my window, and I'd love to be running on it. But believe me, no one is running on it. I think she's got to reopen it pretty soon with special rules and regulations, because it's harder if you're a runner not to be crowded if you haven't got this big stretch of open land to run in. But anyway, that's a minor thing. But I do think that we see the best in one another now, and everyone realizes that we're close together. But, you know, there are other people in America, other states have with different political balances and so on, who think nothing of going, and this was a holiday weekend that we just went through now, having a huge party. There's this lake that's between two southern states called Lake of the Ozarks. And you can see these pictures of people totally flouting the social distancing rules. And then those people come from five or six different states because it's on a border, and they're going to go back and infect the people who've been minding their own business and obeying the rules in all of those states. So, and Chicago, Illinois is next to Wisconsin, where they suspended the rules. They have a Democratic governor who had some very sensible rules, but the Republicans appealed to the Supreme Court, who sided with them, and so they threw out these rules. And now people on the holiday weekend went from Illinois to Wisconsin so they could go to the beach and hang out in large groups. So this is really selfish and stupid. You just infect people in your own family even. But, of course, you infect people that you don't know when you go to the grocery store and so on. So I think we do see the best and worst. And as for the different nations, I mean, on the one hand, we do learn more about other nations. I think people who read the newspaper know something now that they didn't know from all sorts of things, the lockdown in India, the typhoon in India, the political culture of Brazil, and so on. But there's also a tendency to stigmatize. There's a lot of discrimination against Asian Americans in the United States now. They think of it as discrimination against Chinese Americans, but of course Americans can't tell the difference between Korean, Chinese, Japanese. So anyone who looks Asian, they discriminate a lot against them. And those people are under great stress and pressure, even if they've been living in the United States for years. So I think, you know, it's a great mixture, and human beings can be led very easily. Unfortunately, the leadership that Americans have been getting from the top is all in the direction of clannishness and a kind of vicious hatred of other groups and other cultures, and a scapegoating of the Chinese, scapegoating of immigrants for all the problems that we have. And so, I mean, luckily, we're a federated nation, and we have other sources of leadership, like governor, a mayor, and so on. But still, it's very bad that we're getting these very bad signals from the top, along with sheer incompetence, I should add. So we badly, badly, badly need a new sort of leadership. And I think Germany is so lucky. I've always liked Angela Merkel, but I do feel that she's emerged in this crisis very powerfully because of her scientific background and her insistence that things will be done by science with all the testing and the contact tracing. It's really a model of how this thing should be handled everywhere. But she certainly has not indulged in this kind of vicious scapegoating. There are plenty of other leaders also. I mean, even New Zealand, which has certainly closed its borders, didn't do it in a way that scapegoated other people. It was just a health measure. And nothing more. So I think there are many more responsible leaders than irresponsible leaders, but unfortunately, right now, we in America are stuck with one of the irresponsible ones.
You know, what is very interesting is that you have mentioned your city of Chicago twice, because I was thinking, if we are talking about the unit which is sort of between the individual and the whole earth and the whole world, we cannot only talk about the nation state, but we could also talk about cities. And there is this movement of so-called sanctuary cities in the US and elsewhere, cities that in the broadest sense try to act in solidarity with refugees, with migrants, etc. And they do this independent from the countries they belong to. Do you think this could be an alternative to nation states in order to provide...
Well, I mean, of course, the obvious unit that you would go to next is the state, like Illinois, New York, and so on. And that is also quite important and relevant. And the governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo, has been one of the leading figures in this pandemic. But cities, yes, are emerging as of special importance. There's a lot of new scholarship on that. My friend Avner Deshalit from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem has written a wonderful book called Cities and Immigration. And then later, a more popular book has been written by our own former Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. I can't remember what the title of it is, but it's much the same idea, that cities are the wave of the future because this is where immigrants go, this is where new ideas are created, and I think this is true. A vast majority of new immigrants in the United States live in four cities, Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. So, you know, this means there's tremendous movement and tremendous fertility and, indeed, good ideas. Now, of course, then you have to protect the people who are there, and we are a sanctuary city in Chicago. And, of course, every employer knows that you need these new immigrants if you're going to get your work done. But anyway, of course, then the federal government is always threatening to take our money away. But so far, so good. That has not happened yet. We have lots of other problems. Chicago is a very racially polarized city, as I've already mentioned. And, I mean, it's racially polarized in a way that's connected less to hatred than just to economic differences of opportunity. There's de facto segregated housing and differences of quality. And now it turns out that there's need to really reform the whole housing structure, but also the whole health insurance structure. And it's very hard for a city to do that by itself. If you're going to have decent health insurance for all, it can only be done at the national level. So that's why getting better national leadership is so urgently important, I think. But anyway, we certainly are aware of the problems. We also have great problems of violence. And unfortunately, you know, our police department has been more the problem than the solution. Over the years, the police department in Chicago has not defended the rights of African Americans adequately, and therefore they're mistrusted by the community. The community doesn't kind of allow them in or give them information which they could then use to fight crime. This is changing, but it's changing very, very slowly. Our mayor rose to prominence because she was on a police review commission. She was a practicing lawyer in a big firm, but they asked her to be on this commission. And she recommended very strong changes within the police. But, you know, it takes a while. You can't just fire all the old cops. And so we have a new police chief. But the policemen themselves have elected as their union rep, their union chief, a man who has a very bad background where racism is concerned. So we have a lot of struggles still to fight. Cities are all like that. They're a mixture of hope and promise, and if they have good leadership, innovation. But they really do have to contend with differences of opportunity, differences of health opportunities, because we don't have a decent national health care structure, and differences of the police, the way the police treat citizens. I mean, just yesterday, I don't know if you've probably seen this already, in Minnesota, which is a pretty liberal state, in Minneapolis, the police put their neck on the throat of a guy who was simply, he was being arrested because he resembled someone who was wanted for forgery. Now, forgery is a nonviolent crime. Why were they going to put their knee on his neck in the first place? And then he kept saying, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe," and this is all on camera, and eventually he died. So the mayor of Minneapolis has condemned this in the strongest possible terms. But the problem is that the culture of the police is kind of resistant to change, and you don't want to throw these people all out. After all, they're performing a very important public service. So to reform the internal culture of policing is a job that every American city has got to do. And there are a lot of people working on this. A lot of good legal scholars have different models and approaches. And there are cities like Los Angeles that have had a lot of success with community policing. But it's hard for it to take root. And we just need to keep working and working and working. Otherwise, the promise of cities is not going to be realized.
Let us look into the future. There are problems with cosmopolitanism you have already pointed at. But there are aspects which we ought to save. Which are they, and how can we achieve that?
Well, I think what we ought to save is the idea that we're all worthy of equal. We all have human dignity. We are worthy of equal respect and concern. But then how to translate that into action ought to be very complicated and very difficult. We ought to realize, I think, that our big problems, problems of health, problems of environment, problems of global education, are problems that need a cooperative solution involving many, many nations. So we need to come together rather than being apart if we're going to solve humanity's biggest problems. And we haven't yet talked about environment and about animals, but one of the big points I make in the book is that the cosmopolitan tradition was too humanistic, didn't care at all about anyone who wasn't human, and no other animals made their appearance. They used this pejorative rhetoric of the beasts and so on. So we should not think that way. We should think that all sentient beings demand our concern. At least this is what I think. But in any case, we have to put our heads together and use knowledge and use cooperative strategies. But to do it, I think, in each case, from within our own starting point of our own nations. So this means we need very badly a cooperative, deliberative framework. And that, unfortunately, we really don't have that at present. Individual nations have good relations with other individual nations, but the United Nations, by and large, has not fulfilled the hope that most people had for it of being a kind of deliberative parliament in which humanity would get together and solve its problems. And I have to say, I myself don't hold out hope for the United Nations. I worked for a long time in the United Nations project that our capabilities approach was housed for a while in a United Nations agency. And, you know, the trouble with the United Nations is that each nation sends their cronies to be in this or that project. And so the UN gets kind of dumped into it. The people who are unqualified cronies of powerful politicians in each country. And it's a very inefficient and very corrupt institution. So I don't hold out much hope for the UN. I mean, there are certain specific agencies like UNICEF that are better than the others. But I think then it's hard to know how do we get together then? I think it just has to be done by nations getting together with other nations. And, of course, the EU has done this in a pretty admirable way with all the flaws that it has. But the U.S. has increasingly decided we don't want to have anything to do with any other nation, go it alone. And here it's got to be the head of state. And it's not yet the case that a mayor of Chicago can just go to Angela Merkel and say, well, let's meet together and talk about our problems. I think this will happen more and more, that mayors from all over the world will get together, governors of states will get together, and they'll, to some extent, bypass the national structure. But that's not a reality yet. So we need new deliberative frameworks if we're going to follow our own impulse toward greater cooperation and greater deliberation.
So do you think there is an institutional path to cosmopolitanism, and how would these institutions have to look like? What criteria do they need to fulfill?
Well, I think they have to be sort of piecemeal, because I don't believe that we should strive for a world state. I do think that that would not be accountable to people and it wouldn't be a vehicle for their autonomy. So there are certain things that we've already got, like the International Labor Organization. I think that's a pretty decent institution, and the World Trade Association. We also have in the Internet, the World Court. So there are pieces of the institutional structure that exist that are pretty good. But there are other pieces that need far more work. We need much more educational cooperation. So far, we have lots of bilateral educational cooperations, you know, like between the University of Chicago and various institutions in this and that part of the world, but maybe not enough formal structure. I think it would be good to have mayors form an international mayors association that would work on solving the problems of cities that are so common. But right now, it's like freelance, and that's not terrible, because it's good for people to be flexible. So let's say I mentioned a while back my colleague Anoop Malani, who is Indian by origin, he decided, well, I've got this group that I've been working with in India. Let's see what we can do to model the COVID crisis and to work with leaders in different cities in India to see what we can do. And he's doing a lot of valuable work. And if he had to go through a lot of bureaucracy, maybe he wouldn't have been able to do that. So I think this flexibility up to a certain point can be good. I also think that having associations that bring people together is useful. So the economist Amartya Sen and I have founded, and it's now 15 years old, the Human Development and Capability Association, which is an association which has a formal membership of only about 1,000, but it comes and goes because people don't always want to pay dues every year. So it's really much larger than that, and we have annual meetings, and we have a journal. And this brings together people from around 100 countries to deliberate about the problems of economic and social development. And each conference each year has a theme. This year it was supposed to be in New Zealand, and we can't go there because they still don't let tourists come in. So we have to do it virtually. But anyway, next year it's going to be in Antwerp, and that's already being planned, and I hope that will take place. And it does serve as a place where ideas can be floated, young scholars can network, we can cross national divisions, divisions of age, and importantly, divisions between the academy and public policy. So we always get in a lot of practitioners, and then the ideas that we armchair academics have can get out there and make their way into the public space. So, you know, I think that's been a useful association because people who are thinking about these problems get new ideas. They can take it back to their home place. And I do find that when I travel here or there, people know about our capabilities approach now and they're using it in their work, like the Ministry of Human Rights in New Zealand, where I recently visited, seem to know all about this, even though they don't go to the meetings of the association. So I think right now that's what we can do, is build structures that each of us takes some responsibility for. And it's important because we have to uphold quality in selecting the papers for the meetings, and we have to spend a lot of time in making sure that the whole thing doesn't run downhill. The journal is a good journal, and so on. And so let's keep doing that for a while, and then mayors can do the same thing and meet with other mayors. And I'm wary of too large a structure because of my skepticism about the UN. So let's just see what we can do with more informal and more flexible structures and see how much that can influence ultimately the conduct of nations, which is where the action really is.
Martha Nussbaum, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.